Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 16th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. For most of this last week, Americans have been bombarded with propaganda from the Obama administration saying that it's going to tackle the problem of the high cost of health care. You might ask, does this mean an end to HMOs, an end to the insurance companies gouging, and an end to super high prices for pharmaceuticals? If this is what you were thinking, think again. What the so-called behavioral economists who control this administration are planning is what Lyndon LaRouche has described as Nazi medicine. The so-called cost containment will not come from the administrative overhead of existing programs or from cuts in shareholder profits in the healthcare industry, the private healthcare industry. All that's going to be maintained, perhaps even increased. Instead, the savings will come from denying care through a policy modeled on that of the Nazis, a looting policy, plain and simple, to squeeze every bit of liquidity from us, then toss us, the American people, on a human scrap heap. On today's program, we will investigate why it is accurate to describe these policies as those of Nazi medicine, how the originators of these plans, especially Office of Management and Budget Director Peter Orszag and his top deputy for healthcare, Ezekiel Emanuel, are prepared to treat the elderly, the disabled, and those with chronic illnesses as useless eaters, and how using the guidelines drafted by the Allies to prosecute Nazi doctors at the Nuremberg Tribunal, anyone, including the president, who advocates this approach to health care should be removed immediately before they can initiate a policy of mass murder against the American people. Joining me today on the LaRouche Show will be the co-host of the LaRouche Show, Marcia Mary Baker, who has just written an article for the next EIR titled Save Lives, Save the Nation, End HMOs, Rebuild the Hill-Burton Hospital System. And Nancy Spanis, the editor of the EIR, who has written a chilling article for the upcoming EIR special report on this, titled The Nazi Precedent for Obama's Health Plan. Now is the time to say never again. We will also be joined by Michelle Fuchs from the LaRouche Youth Movement, who just has a very nice LaRouche Pack TV posting up on the LaRouche Pack website on this whole question of Nazi medicine. So Marcia, Nancy, and Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Marcia, let me begin with you. What exactly was presented this week by the administration, and what's wrong with their approach? Now, the second part is a broad question, but let's just start with what are they saying they're going to do?
Well, here's where it stands. There's been a bum's rush to have right from the top a new enabling legislation pushed through Congress by the White House and Max Baucus in Congress and Charles Grassley, the Republican, together, to have a bill by June that would allow the sweeping denial of care, all the other measures you just alluded to that we're calling Nazi medicine. And where it stands this past week is that the public propaganda was finished with the third roundtable held in the Senate that was presided over by the Democrat Max Baucus and by Grassley. And that these roundtables brought together nominally stakeholders. You should think of it as a Dracula movie, but, you know, insurance companies, nurses associations and so forth, everyone's supposed to get involved. And before that, in March and April, there were five field hearings by the White House, one in Los Angeles, two summits by the White House, all of this to motivate the new legislation that we're talking about, and the final secret meeting on it, that is behind closed doors, will be this coming week in the Senate before the recess by Congress for Memorial Day week. And they are planning to have Senate action on it in June and pass all this in June and July.
Well, Marcia, they say that they're going to save, the president initially said they're going to save $2 trillion, and then that was thrown into dispute as to whether they agreed to that or not. But how are they going to get these savings?
Well, these figures that are put out, as you said, the line is they take what's said to be spent on health care altogether every year in the United States, around $2 to $2.5 trillion. That's by everything, Medicare, private, public, you name it. It is said in recent months, and this is what the White House says, and Peter Orszag, whom you mentioned, says, if we just cut out unnecessary care, unnecessary overhead, cut out all kinds of things, we can save $700 billion. And the way they describe this is look at a map of the United States, look at the fact that in the state of Washington, the average money spent on a person's health care if they're over 66 years old and have Medicare is $6,400, whereas in New York State it's $8,400. Let's bring everything down to $6,400. Let's take it even lower. That's one kind of thing.
Well, is the standard then the money, or is it the quality of care for the money? It sounds as though they're simply looking at dollar figures.
This is all money, but the rationalization and the propaganda may be that we will have more quality and value care and at the same time spend less money.
Okay, now let's, because we're going to talk to Nancy in a second about how this is modeled on what was done by the Nazis, let's just hone in on this, because you know from, you've written extensively on the question of when the United States had a healthcare system that actually functioned, as opposed to what we have now. Just a couple of quick points. I mean, one is that LaRouche said if you wanted to save money, you start cutting the overhead that's in the existing HMO system. Now, they're not talking about that, though, are they?
Not at all. I mentioned these stakeholders around the table in either the Senate or the White House. They included the CEO of Aetna. That's one of the top five so-called managed care companies in the country. The others include names like WellPoint, Humana, Cigna, and so forth. It is the top, these five plus another 40 or so, control the care, decisions about care for over 160 million Americans. They are the ones that are now from the top instead of from the sidelines in on making the new arrangements where in a wholesale way they could wipe out, for example, and this is being discussed, any care that a person may get in what's called their last 6 months of their lives. How you're going to figure that at age 40 or 60 or 20, one doesn't know. But this is the kind, they say that if you cut out excessive care given in the last 6 months of people's lives, you would save millions.
And are they going to try and get some kind of consensus on what is so-called excessive or unnecessary care?
Well, that brings up the this idea of who sets the criteria, and they are discussing that now there must be a commission to do that. It can be modeled on the one that, guess where, set it up already in Britain. It's called the National Institutes of Clinical Excellence, and for over 10 years, this entity in Britain, headed up by a Sir Michael Rawlins, who's conferring here in the United States, they decide what kind of care should be given, what a physician can do in the case of cancer or in the case of kidney failure, etc. So this kind of criteria, namely, what is considered evidence-based, there's jargon for this, practices, what are the comparative effectiveness of different kinds of care. This kind of list that would be then applied to what any doctor or any hospital or any provider in the country might do is what's being discussed to be implemented from the top.
All right. Well, Nancy, you've heard what Marsh has described, and I know you've been reading up on this. How is this comparable to what was done by the Nazis beginning in particular, 1939?
The fact is that the thinking that is going into this acknowledges one crucial philosophical similarity with the Nazis, which leads to everything, and that's that there is such a thing as a life unworthy of life. This is a phrase and a concept that comes, that was made immortal, so to speak, till we kill it, by Hitler himself when he wrote the infamous top secret euthanasia decree of the fall of 1939. What happened at that point is that the war had come on. In fact, prior to the war in the summer, Hitler was discussing with the Secretary of Health how they were going to manage their resources in the course of the war, and he told the Secretary of Health at that point that he considered it proper that life unworthy of life of severely mentally ill people could be eliminated by actions that bring about death because, quote, a certain saving in hospitals, doctors, and nursing personnel could be brought about.
So this was the explicit policy then after September or October 1939?
This was the policy prior to him giving the order. But when he gave the order, he put a whole new apparatus into effect. There had been euthanasia prior to this order. It had been considered a mercy death, so-called, in euphemistic language, and Hitler was personally consulted about it. But come October, he, in his own hand, wrote a decree under the title of Destruction of Lives Unworthy of Life, handed it to his personal doctor, Karl Brandt, who was in charge of the program, laying out that Brandt and another Nazi leader, quote, are charged with the responsibility for expanding the authority of physicians to be designated by name to the end that patients considered incurable according to the best available human judgment of their state of health can be accorded a mercy death, unquote. Now you would, everyone would say, well, you know, that's simply a question of whether people want to die, right? That heavy propaganda in the United States about wanting to die. But in fact, what that triggered was an immediate mandate that all state institutions were required to report and hand in the names of those patients who have been ill for 5 years or more or were unable to work. Fill out the questionnaire, what's their name, what's their race, you know, who's paying for them, how many people were visiting them, and then on the basis of this expert consultation, a number of consultants, mostly professors of psychiatry, would make the decision as to who should be eliminated.
So essentially then, the policy started with what was an economic issue. I mean, they were clear on the economics, that they couldn't afford to keep people alive whose life was supposedly not worth living. Now, when we hear about this today, and especially the figure that sticks out to me, Marcia mentioned $700 billion, that connects very nicely with a $700 billion bailout of bad debt. But are they, would you say, Nancy, it's fair to say that they're making basically the same argument today, that the economic conditions require that there be so-called comparative effectiveness or whatever you want to call it, that this is the parallel to the Nazi policy?
There is absolutely a parallel on the cost effectiveness, which really is more what they really mean by comparative effectiveness. They
right.
mean, and they memorialize this with making up these terms like quality adjusted life years, something that Peter Orszag has talked about, where he says, well, you know, if we save you with this kind of illness, you know, how many quality adjusted life years do you have left? Is it worth it for us to save you each year being worth $100,000 or something of that sort. That kind of measurement absolutely is. But there's a point that you get to that leads you to that, because there may very well be people even in the Obama administration or the president himself who don't think of it that way. But the result of their thinking that there are people who are useless and therefore should not be saved, useless to society, we can't afford to save them, is affecting their thinking and will lead to this euthanasia result. There's what I found very striking interchange or statement in the Nuremberg Tribunal, because Hitler's doctor claimed that these were mercy deaths. After all, these people were living terrible lives. They probably weren't being fed very much in their institutions, right? Maybe they weren't being visited by their family. Maybe it was a really dismal existence. They were putting them out of their misery, quite literally. And, you know, he considered death as a deliverance. Death is part of life. How often do you hear that these days?
Well, Nancy, I think I'd like you to read the quote from Dr. Leo Alexander, who was the medical advisor at the Nuremberg Tribunal, because I think this gets to the core of the matter, that no matter what they say to justify, there's a principle underlying it, and I think that's the one that you get from Dr. Leo Alexander.
Absolutely. There are a number of them, but the first one, let me see if there's a better, if the best one is later on.
I think the one where he actually mentions euthanasia in the...
Right.
Starting with a small...
Yes, yes. Whatever proportions these... Now, this, people should realize, this was written in 1949. This is 3 years after the atrocities of Hitler were smashed all over the press, right? And already... This physician, who was a psychiatrist, who had participated in the prosecutions of the Nazi doctors, saw the shift toward fascism in the United States, which, of course, Lynn has identified as coming very rapidly on with the Truman administration coming in. And he said, speaking of mostly of the medical community, but relating it to the overall situation, whatever proportions these crimes finally assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude. It started with the acceptance of the attitude, basic in the euthanasia movement, that there is such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived. This attitude in its early stages concerned itself merely with the severely and chronically sick. Gradually, the sphere of those to be included in this category was enlarged to encompass the socially unproductive, the ideologically unwanted, and finally all non-Aryans. But it is important to realize that the infinitely small wedge-in lever from which this entire trend of mind received its impetus was the attitude toward the non-rehabilitatable sick.
And so what we have with that quote is Dr. Leo Alexander saying that it was from that small beginning that we ended up with the mass death in the concentration camp, the extermination that was carried out by the Nazis against Jews and other minorities, that he's saying that it was that line that was crossed to accept the idea that there's not that there are lives that are not worth living. That's the point he was making when he wrote that.
Absolutely, and he puts it in terms of Hegelianism, but many of our listeners might not recognize that. Perhaps the best parallel in English-speaking culture is Benthamism. It's utilitarianism, and what he says later, just to underscore the point, he says it is natural in a dictatorship. And here we're talking about a dictatorship of public opinion, really, and British thinking, that eventually the principle, what is useful is good, wins out completely. The killing center is the reductio ad absurdum, the ultimate, as you put it, the ultimate bottom line of all health planning based on only rational principles and economy, rational in quotes, and not on humane compassion and divine law.
Well, I hope our listeners are taking this in. It is up on, a lot of this is posted now on the LaRouchePack.com website. We're going to be updating this. We're going to get to Michelle Fuchs, who was just in a meeting this morning with Lyndon LaRouche, in just a moment. But you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 16th, 2009, and we really are at a point in the battle where the current administration has gone into a full-fledged assault against basic principles of human life and dignity. Now, Marcia, I'd like to come back to you on this question that Nancy just raised of utilitarianism, because we've had several programs on the LaRouche Show on this recently, and I know people have said to me they didn't quite get it, what we were talking about with behavioral economics. But the key figure here is really this Benthamite concept, isn't it, that there's somehow a way that you have to essentially modify people's behavior so that they'll accept that these things which lead to much greater consequences, that you get people to accept that. Why don't you say just how this fits in with this behavioral economics outlook of people like Larry Summers and, of course, Orszag?
Well, there, among the facets of this, there are, as one person said, a woman named Gail Walensky, who really is a kind of Nazi doctor consultant and has participated in the roundtables and worked for George H.W. Bush in Medicare. She said, look, we have to manage people's perceptions right now in the United States. There's a new president in. We've hammered home that health care costs are unsustainable. That's another one of your jargon words.
Right.
And there isn't enough money, there isn't enough resources, so there's going to have to be tough choices. And we can manage people's perceptions of that. And one way that you see a lot of that is it's said everyone can be made to agree there should be lifestyle taxes, put it that way, around the country. You have too many overweight people using up resources. People who smoke are getting treated for lung cancer. This should be stopped. We'll be able to appeal to the popular single issue opinion of people, of the general population, that it's just wrong for treating people's gastrointestinal problems if they drank too much. This is all out there right now in ways to just create the conditions for ramming through from the top these sweeping measures to deny people health care and to up the death rate and the sickness rate. So that's one of the aspects of this one side of behavioralism in action.
Okay, and Nancy, when you look at this in the degeneration of the political debate over the last 40 years, it seems to me this is exactly when you were first recruited to working with Lyndon LaRouche, which was way back in the dark ages.
Absolutely.
A long, long time ago. This is exactly what the issue at that time, that Lynn was going on the campuses and pointing out that we're facing a dark age based on the revival of these kinds of ideas which were at the core of fascism.
Well, actually, at that time, which was 1968, was the beginning of the institutionalization of the death movement around the Club of Rome. And those who said that we had too many people on this earth and we basically had to figure out a way to lower their living standards and ultimately reduce their numbers. This was a major element of the propaganda of the counterculture and has turned into this, to now the dominant culture. The green culture comes
right
precisely from this. And the one thing that I would stress at this point that Lynn said this morning in discussion was, look, Obama if we don't stop him from doing what actually is unconstitutional, taking away the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of the population through this Nazi healthcare policy, then he is going to lose popularity among most of the American population, true enough. But he could bring the whole country down with him. But we should be aware that the people who are supporting him are the Greens. They're the Malthusians who came out of this anti-technology movement, who are gung-ho for self-righteous genocide, literally. And what we should do with those people is say, you're green? I'm sorry, I don't like Hitler. I'm against greenies.
Well, and this is totally implicit in the energy policy and the argument. Again, when we talk about these catchwords, they say we want energy independence, and so you're going to stick a windmill on your roof and a solar panel in your backyard and then freeze to death in the winter.
And by the way, Harley, when you asked about the last 4 decades, I guess it is, I'm just looking at a timeline from 1996 we put together. And you see the same figures as who's doing evil today. George Soros, November 1996, sets up a foundation called the Death Committee. This is to look into, it's called Project on Death. And every few years, this kind of thing was furthered. Governor Lamb from out west. Remember him from Colorado?
Yeah, it should be like leaves. When your time is up, you fall from the tree.
That's right. So the same cast of characters studying the so-called culture of dying and how to further this. So today, you put in money terms about unsustainability. You're getting proposals for this new bill that hasn't been unveiled yet, but for such things as ACOs, accountable care organizations, these would be a successor to mere health maintenance organizations. Forget the health part. And the care would be, whether you get treatment or not, would be determined by this nexus, which is really the neo-1939 Nazi health department.
Well, you know, if you think about this, that 25 years ago, 30 years ago, they were beginning to push the idea of a hospice movement. And what they've done in the last 10 years or so is they've prettied it up a little bit, made it seem less ominous as it was initially. But this was essentially at the point at which you decide people no longer have a life worth living, you just cast them into some place and you help them ease the passage. And this is something that's become very acceptable.
You know, absolutely.
And again, this is the small beginnings. Once you accept this, you have created conditions where you can have mass death. One of you mentioned the question of alcoholism. You know, one of the things the Nazis did is I think there were somewhere around 70,000 so-called alcoholics that they just disappeared and murdered. So we can see this fairly clearly. Now, I'd like to bring in Michelle Fuchs, who is substantially younger than the three of us, but is learning this history very quickly and is becoming an effective spokesman for taking this on. Michelle, what would you like to say about this? What do we have to do to fight this outlook in the population?
Well, the first thing that we need to do is not be afraid of calling it what it is. Now, right now, across the country, the LaRouche youth movement is gearing up on this fight where we're not going to go out and explain the details of what these policies are, but we're going to say up front what they are is Nazism and what they are is the kind of policy that Hitler was calling for in Germany, which is explicitly what this is. A point I would make is right now the population is turning from what was initially a hopeful sense of what the president would be doing, what Obama would be doing, to starting to get that sinking feeling and not really liking the guy so much anymore, because what Obama is exposing is his true colors. He's exposing what Lyndon LaRouche identified quite some time ago as a Nero complex, Obama is concerned about his status. He's concerned about his ego. And it doesn't really matter to him if his policies are right or not. So right now he's taking advice from a group of crazy behaviorists and has essentially signed on to Nazi policies, admitting that he himself, if he didn't have the outright cash to pay for his grandmother's hip replacement, he wouldn't have been so sure about doing it since she was going to die soon anyway. And that's not the kind of thinking that you want from a president of the United States. What Mr. LaRouche went through this morning really clearly is the fight that we're in is a continuation of the fight against empire, that what Hamilton did, what Alexander Hamilton did, and his collaborators, Benjamin Franklin and others, in the founding of the nation, was they set up the mechanisms whereby the United States could protect its population. We had a system set up where we could have health care and could have the proper standard of living for our population, and that was constitutionally put in. And this morning, what Mr. LaRouche set out is the United States is precisely where this fight is going to have to come from, because the United States has the mechanisms of a credit system. And we have a potential political fight on our hands if we can mobilize the population against these Nazi policies. So we have the mechanisms, and that's precisely what we need to take up. Take up the idea. Use the mechanisms of a credit system.
You know, I've just finished a week of a couple of town meetings, and I presented precisely this question right off the top, that what we're facing is a transformation, a rapid transformation into Nazi medicine. And I hit it and hit it and hit it. And people in the audience, their initial reaction was they wanted to talk about how the bailout's bad and how they're being screwed by Goldman Sachs. And it was very difficult to get people to face up to the fact that, as you're saying, Michelle, that they have to face this right now, that this is Nazism, that this is the same philosophical set of principles that led to the slaughter and genocide under the Nazis in World War II. And you find very quickly the extent to which people have illusions. And I wonder, Nancy, if you, in what you wrote about the Leo Alexander, in a sense as a voice of conscience, within a few years after some of the Nazi doctors were hanged at Nuremberg, that within a few years he had to call people's attention to that. As someone who's been organizing for years, these illusions in the population are what the behavioral economists are counting on, aren't they?
I think that people probably feel very guilty, which is why they don't respond. Because as you said a little while ago, this has been going on for a number of decades, really intensively. Marcia could look it up, but I believe that it was as early as 1983 that hospices began to be covered by Medicare, right? After a fairly intense 15 years or so before that of hospices coming in to the repertoire, so to speak, as some professional might say it, of so-called medical treatment. And, you know, the same thing happened in Germany. There were popular movies about people euthanizing their spouse as a kind thing to do. There was popular propaganda about the cost of keeping mentally ill people alive versus the cost of providing low-cost housing for your normal working person. And we have that in our schools today. I don't remember, I haven't looked at it recently, but they teach, they teach so-called economics in high schools and grade schools today. And what they mean is, you know, trade-offs between what you can afford and what you can't afford. They're not talking about leaps of technology that will allow you to feed and care for more people. So the fact is that the propaganda has really infected people to the way that they see their relatives. And I think when we put the mirror up, when you put the mirror up to say, looking at your, at this issue of healthcare for someone in your family is, you know, in the way that you are, is Nazi thinking of thinking, well, they don't have that much time left anyway. Well, I can't really afford it. Well, I don't have a job. Well, I just have to do it, is terrifying to people in the sense of their own sense of identity. That's what I would think to be the case.
Harley and yes. Michelle, let me throw something in here too, because Michelle used the expression, that sinking feeling. When you're seeing the president speak and he's saying we're going to have better care and it's going to cost less, wherever you are in the country, unless you're under a rock, you know that the local hospital might be shutting down, that the that you might have to drive five counties over and find gas money if you want to get something checked out. And just the sheer facing the fact of the institutions lying in your face is a scary thing. And what I want to throw in is already the sweeping denial of care. We know it's said, because the president says it all the time too, 46 or 50 million Americans don't have health care, and that's terrible. But look at it another way. There are hospitals shutting down now every day in cities, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and in rural counties. We've lost 16% or more of the emergency rooms over the last 10 years. We aren't screening for breast cancer anymore among women, one of the easiest things to early detect and treat. We've reduced screening in the last 8 years by about 16 or 20%. We don't have machines to do it anymore in many counties in many states. We don't have public health workers, and yet we're facing a flu pandemic. So already everything is, the physical resources aren't there that were there 10 or 20 years ago. We have more people in worse shape, and you get the institutions in Washington telling you, oh, it's easy, we'll cut out what care shouldn't be given, and it'll be better care. So you know it's straight lies.
Well, Marcia, we have an email from a listener, Richard in Dallas, Texas, who brings up this point. I can, from his email, it seems as though he is a supporter of the single-payer health care, and he said there were people involved in this who were in Washington this week, many of whom are practicing physicians and nurses. And they've taken petitions, letters, emails, and they've said it's totally ineffective because members of Congress are hit regularly by lobbyists for the for-profit healthcare industry. And so he says, I don't have to tell you the difficulties confronted when attempting to scale the castle walls of Washington. And Michelle, this is really a question for you. What can an average citizen do to turn the tide of big money and influence when the moat is full of alligators?
Well, that is a good question. That's the kind of question that you need to also evoke from your friends, your neighbors, and anyone else you can get in touch with who wants to do something about this political situation. What we're doing as a national movement is we are setting up forums to bring up this discussion. We have a web page that we're using as a medium to get out to, in particular, the youth generation, what's going on in video form and text form. And you know, we're fundraising to do these activities. And you can call up your legislators and get other people to send in things to let them know that you're fed up with what's going on.
And I think the most important thing is what you said earlier from Mr. LaRouche. You have to tell people what's actually happening, because people are demoralized. They do have a sense that this is a crisis that we're not escaping, that it's getting worse. And what I saw in Salt Lake City, what I saw in Detroit, was a certain amount of despair and pessimism. Now, sometimes people think that if you just start with the truth, it's going to make people more depressed. But if people don't know what the fight is, if they don't know what they're up against, they're not going to be able to be rallied to mobilize to fight. So I go ahead, Michelle.
There's a funny thing that happens. The story of the Emperor's New Clothes is a good example of this, where, without going through the whole story, as soon as this child, who wasn't overburdened with all these ideas about what they were and were not allowed to say, pointed out the truth of what was going on in explicit terms, it broke the tension from everyone in attendance, and suddenly people were willing to say what was the truth. Now, Mr. LaRouche is the best example of doing this. What he's doing right now in calling out this Nazi policy for what it is, that's the kind of thing that will break the tension and allow people to address the reality and not be afraid of saying something. One of the reasons in Germany, you know, people still ask the question of how did things get so bad? How did people just go along with orders and not say anything when they knew something was going on? So what we're doing in this organization is we're making sure that is being said, that the truth is being said, and you know, so we can create the kind of a spark that will fire this discussion up before things get worse, before things get irreparable.
And this should be done in every circumstance, in your family gatherings, in company picnics, at the workplace. I mean, people have to discuss this, get it out on the table. Now, I have another question. By the way, we are taking email questions for our panel. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's LaRouchePub.com. We have one from Greg, who raises an interesting question about the concept of health insurance. And he says, isn't it time to begin a real discussion as to the value of paying into health insurance? And what he goes on to say is that instead of money going into insurance companies that Wall Street then uses, and we look at AIG and the mess with all the insurance industry tied up with derivatives and so on, he said, instead of money being lost in those companies, shouldn't there be a discussion about bankrupting those organizations and instead putting money directly into actual health care? And he points out that these insurance companies are part of the grouping that are involved in elimination of health care. Nancy, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think that the insurance companies are heavily owning these health maintenance organizations. I don't know who's going to own the accounting, whatever Marcia said, that was really chilling to
accountable
me.
Care organizations.
Accountable care organizations. That's like one other step.
Sounds like funeral parlors to me.
Yeah, sounds that way too. I remember clearly talking about the old days. In New York City back in the late 1960s, I was working for the city of New York for a brief period of time, and all of a sudden they changed the name of the welfare department to the human resources department. And somehow that sounded very Nazi-like to me. All of a sudden people are resources instead of people. But anyway.
But see, the question really gets at, I think, the idea of the Hill-Burton, and maybe as an alternative to this, maybe I should actually go to Marcia since you just wrote the article on it. And I don't want to get away from this question of the Nazi medicine, so
right.
We'll come back to this.
Right.
But just for a brief moment, Marcia, you don't have to put all this money into insurance companies and HMOs, do you?
Right. And the record stands that after the Second World War, it was 1956 to be exact, a new law was passed. This was called the Hospital Survey and Construction Act. It was called Hill-Burton because the bipartisan co-sponsors were a man from Alabama named Lister Hill. It was named after Lister of Listerine. He was
right.
A physician. But he worked for the Tennessee Valley Authority. He worked for industrialization of the South. And a gentleman from Ohio named Burton, Harold Burton, a Republican. Anyway, this 9-page amendment to the U.S. public health law, standing law, said that all of the 3,000-some counties in the U.S. should be surveyed, and where there was any significant population instead of Elk County in Montana or something, make sure there's a community hospital to serve the people there and have modern medicine ratios of, say, 4 to 5 beds per 1,000 people who live there and do other things like that. And over the 40s to 70s, this building project was carried out, and a couple thousand hospitals, some in counties that never had one before at all in history, were built. And this was, at the time, the nature of how they were used included the fact you could go there and pay for what you needed yourself. It might only cost two or three paychecks. It included the fact that there were charity hospitals, Catholic, Hebrew, Jewish hospitals, Shriners hospitals. It included that there were hospitals run by the county government. And it included nonprofit insurance. They were, at the time, remember, Blue Cross Blue Shield, another nonprofit insurance, then some for-profit insurance by Prudential and Aetna. It worked. It was working in the 60s, pretty much in the 70s, and then after the 1973 Nixon administration change to the startup, the health maintenance organization, private managed care, so-called, leeches and looting operations. Well, anyway, it worked up till then, and then over the past 3 to 4 decades, the infrastructure did not continue to be built. The ratios have declined, and billions of dollars have gone into this echelon of insurance and banking interests that persist to this day, and now want the final blood money.
Well, it seems as though there's a very distinct parallel, if you look at this, between the Hill-Burton, on the one hand, which was a policy that worked, and also Glass-Steagall, which was a policy that worked for regulating banks for a long time. And what we've seen over the last 35, 40 years is getting rid of these kinds of policies, which are unique to the United States, and replacing them with these radical, for-profit, free market policies. Now, Nancy, if you could just comment on this change, because I think this is the parallel to this is the devaluing of human life, that everything gets turned into what is the immediate source of profit, the casino economy. Go ahead.
Yeah, a number of things rush to mind, but because it all goes together with this, with the implications of a post-industrial society, which comes into effect, you know, through the empire, through the British Empire's way of running world economy, in the intensive, you know, increasingly from 1968 on. One thing Lynn stressed today again was the radical shift involved in March 1st, 1968, when Johnson signed on in a precursor to the 1971 taking the dollar off gold. Johnson caved in to the British in a move toward eliminating control over the U.S. currency, separating the general welfare from the management of the currency. This was the beginning of a radical shift toward post-industrialism. And what does post-industrialism mean from the British imperial standpoint in practicality? It was explained by Henry Carey back in the middle of the 19th century. It means cheapening human life, because an industrial society increases the value, invests in human life, wants to have a higher standard of living, wants to put more resources into the quality of human life, as opposed to the doublespeak that's talked about these days, where they say quality of human life is just not having a little pain over the last 2 months. So, in fact, think of what brain games have been carried out since the beginning of the Obama administration. The Obama administration came in saying, with the economic crisis on its plate, you know, financial crisis, economic crisis, blowout, the only solution was to deal with that and have economic growth. And in fact, economic growth is the solution to the healthcare problem. I mean, to the extent that our population is aging and so forth and so on, we need actual economic growth. We need to employ more people at better paying jobs and more productive work.
Well, on the flip side of that, we have this quote from Ezekiel Emanuel.
Absolutely.
From this 2008 article. So this was October 13, 2008. He and a co-author from Stanford, another place that's not unknown for supporting genocide,
right?
They write that we have long maintained that we will get health care reform only when there is a war, a depression, or some other major civil unrest. It's beginning to look like we might just have all three, unquote.
Right.
And that, I think, is parallel to President Obama's idiotic statement about the stars being aligned for this.
Right. But in fact, he switched the agenda from solving the economic crisis in a, you know, by reindustrializing the country to saying, no, we're going to solve the economic crisis by cutting health care. He now says it's the other way around. Don't solve the health care crisis by reindustrializing, but slash health care to supposedly help, you know, solve the economic crisis, which in fact is, as you pointed out before, just happens to be the amount of money being poured into the financial
institutions. And I think from that, it's very clear that you can go right back to the Nazi question, because
absolutely,
this is why Hitler was put in power by a group of financiers, including top people from the Bank of England, as well as the American side, the Harriman, Prescott, Bush interests. And again, I'd like to just close out. We have about 9 minutes, but hone in on this one more time. Well, what was it that actually was behind this Nazi doctor policy in Germany, either Nancy or Marcia? And then, Michelle, I want to come back to you in just a minute.
The British were pushing this policy of useless eaters and getting rid of useless eaters throughout their entire imperial life. They began very early when they took over as the center from Venice. And they pressed it in the United States, and they pressed it throughout the rest of the world. The point was to maintain the imperial power which they had against populations which, if they were educated and improved in their living standard, would demand republics, would demand sovereign republics that would revolt against this global imperial system. And in fact, you know, they were, after the death of Lincoln, they were extremely successful in the academic world at pushing the idea of eugenics, that there is a, you know, there are racial characteristics which are bred into people. They included things like pauperism. I went back and looked at the speech I wrote at the beginning of the Club of Life in 1982, you know, their whole list of the congenital, so-called congenital evils included being poor, you know.
Well, this, you see this today in terms of some of the way Republicans get roped into this, with the idea that the inferior Mexicans are coming over to take advantage of our health care system, or you know, the people who won't work, who are demanding care, that's the reason we're bankrupt.
Right.
You see the same social Darwinism, as you pointed out. This goes back to Galton in the 19th century and these kinds of theories.
Right. So, in fact, they pushed it everywhere, and it was very strong in the United States. You know, and as I say in the article, which, you know, I would think people should, you know, ultimately get on the site to look at, is that only thanks to the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt and the grouping behind him did we not have the same thing in the United States. There were mass movements behind these kinds of racist ideas. But in Germany, the bankers were able to pull it off. They were able to, the leadership was weak there. They, you know, installed Hitler. They poured money into Hitler when his cause was flagging. Then they installed Hitler, and they supported him all the way up till he threatened England, and which he did when he successfully conquered France. And they supported his so-called racial hygiene policies at notable conferences, which we've publicized, of the Harrimans et al. So, in fact, it is a British imperial outlook on mankind that led them to carry out this policy in Germany because they wanted to destroy Germany as an industrial power, and that they carry it out today because they want to destroy the United States as the only unique power, which is another point Lynn made today, that could reverse this depression worldwide. The British we are in a war with Great Britain, and we have to be in a war against our president with Nazi policies until, you know, because he's joined the enemy at this point.
Yeah, I think this is a key point that whatever people thought of Obama during the campaign or when he came in, and a lot of people didn't like him and didn't trust him, but what he's doing right now is unacceptable and has to be defeated. I would encourage people to go to the LaRouchePub.com website, where we will have the articles from Marcia and Nancy. This will be, I guess, a special issue of the next issue of the EIR. Now, let me get back to Michelle, because Michelle posted a very good, short, punchy LPAC TV video yesterday. Michelle, what are we going to be doing with the website to give people the tools to win this fight?
Well, what we're pulling together to put up on the website is a series of different looks at what this Nazi policy really is, from the perspective of what is going on right now, what are the policies being proposed by Peter Orszag and the rest of the Obama behavioral dog school, as well as the policies of the actual Nazis. And to look at not just what were the policies, but how did you get a population to comply with it? You have that cultural element of the famous Nuremberg trial excuse, Befehl ist Befehl. An order is an order. So to challenge viewers of the website and anyone with not just going along to get along with a fascist Nazi policy, but to consider fighting against it.
Well, many of the people who went along to get along ended up in the gas chambers of the concentration camps. And I understand that when Peter Orszag was confronted at the correspondence dinner last week with being an author of Nazi policies, he wasn't too happy about that.
That was fun. You know, he actually went running. He said, well, I don't know what you mean by that. And Bill Jones said very forthrightly, well, it means taking the money from healthcare and giving it to the banks. And he ran away.
Well, you know, one of the things you find is that it's the distance that people like Orszag have from their policies that when they're confronted with it, you find the real cowardice.
Right.
This was pointed out by studies done of the Nazis at Nuremberg. In fact, Goering killed himself rather than face the consequences of his crimes. That they're deep down, they're cowards, and they have to be confronted, and they can be. And that includes the Congress. So we're running short on time. Marcia, do you have anything quick to add?
No, but, you know, there was life before HMOs. That's the thing you're up against sometimes, is people, the cynicism, the depression or something, people saying, oh, you can't change it. It's been with us so long. So LaRouche's insistence, ban the HMOs, kill the HMOs and save the people.
Yeah, just as I think you could say, just as Orszag or Emmanuel see this as an opportunity to this crisis as an opportunity to impose the evil policies. We have the opportunity, as was done with Franklin Roosevelt, as Nancy pointed out, in the 1930s, to use this as an opportunity to revitalize the Republican constitutional traditions of our nation. And this is an opportunity that if we miss, then the world will be, as LaRouche has been insisting, condemned to a prolonged dark age. So go to our website, LaRouchePact.com. Go to the EIR website, LaRouchePub.com, and become armed for the battle, because you cannot escape it. There's no such thing as individual survival under these circumstances, as millions of Jews in Germany discovered to their horror. Don't let that happen again. That's what never again means. Marcia, Nancy, and Michelle, thank you very much. This has been another edition of The LaRue Show. We'll be back next Saturday. And in the meantime, the new webcast pamphlet, the one from April 28th, is now available. You can call LaRouche PAC at 800-929-7566 to order copies of it and get it around and become the instigator of reason in your neighborhood. Okay, so thank you very much, and we'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.